Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th president of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where it's my great pleasure to have as my guest this evening a brilliant statistician and analyst of vote fraud, election theft here in the USA. You thought it couldn't happen here, but it seems to be ubiquitous. His name, Richard Charnin. He's published on this issue, and he's here to share some of his analysis of what's going on today with the primaries, especially related to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Richard, welcome to The Real Deal.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be here.
Tell us a bit about your book.
Yeah, well, I've written 2 books. The good news is my old book, the big book, Proving Election Fraud, which I was not able to lower the price. It was very expensive, $26, 450 pages, written in 2010. Anyway, I just made an ebook out of it. You can get it for $3.99. So I'm hoping that people pick it up, even though it's 2010. It's still got a lot of information. And the other book, Matrix of Deceit, which was published in 2012, is available as well. They're both available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can get that on Amazon. So both books you can get for $12. Or just get, you know, whatever anybody wants. I cover as much as I can. Unfortunately, I didn't cover 2014 and 2015 and 16, but that'll come out in an update or a new book towards the end of the year. I'm waiting for these primaries to be over so that I got something I could write about. But I plan to come up with a third book because what has taken place over the last couple of years has been quite dramatic.
Well, Richard, let's turn to your desktop and explain, you know, what you got here for us, because it looks very impressive.
Yeah, well, what I want to do, and what I've done in a lot of these interviews, is I like to go through the basic bedrock proof of election fraud for those who are unaware of the mathematical proofs that we have systemic election fraud. Now, so what I'd like to do is just go over briefly my basic proof in English language. Okay, it's just the concept is very important, because the concept of the exit polls and matching to the recorded vote, that process takes place in every election, in the primaries, in the governor elections, in the presidential elections. in all elections where there's any exit polls, the exit poll that's printed is really inaccurate. It does nothing more than hide the election fraud that took place. So let me just review that real quick. I started posting on election fraud right after the 2004 election, when online, and there was many observers of these debates. I was basically saying that it was stolen, and then you had a lot of people who came after me as a tinfoil hat, conspiracy theorist. They didn't know who I was. I had a screen name, Truth Is All, and I didn't really want to reveal my identity. And they figured I was some kid up in working out of his basement. They didn't really have any idea of my background. And my background, I think, speaks for itself. I worked in the defense industry in the 60s with the mainframe computers developing software for manufacturing the naval aircraft. And I worked with a guy who worked on a lunar module. Then in the 70s, I went to Wall Street, worked there for over 10 years in investment banking, developing models. I was the first one on Wall Street ever to use spreadsheets for modeling. Very first one. I was doing financial analysis, mergers and acquisitions. I'm not a Johnny come lately, but no, the people thought that I, you know, so whatever I'm doing is based on my analytical background. I am unbiased. If Bush won fairly in 2004, I would have come up with that. Even though I didn't like the guy, I would have said, yeah, he won, but he didn't win. People still give me grief, and they say he won in 2000, 2004. That shows you the level of ignorance that's out there. In any case, I got all the exit polls, state unadjusted exit polls from 1988 to 2008 presidential elections. And that was a couple of years. That was around 2010. We didn't have them in 2004. We had preliminary exit polls, but not the real raw exit polls. But we got that information. The University of Connecticut had it. And I manually got the data, the exit poll data, for each state, for each of these six elections, manually transcribed into a spreadsheet. And what I found out was very significant. The Democrats, when you took a look at the total exit poll average, the presidential exit polls, Democrats won by 52% to 42%. Now that's a nice fat margin. And also national exit polls, same thing. But in the recorded vote, they won by 48% to 46%. So right away, you have an 8% differential in margin. The probability of that occurring over six elections, over actually 274 exit polls, is one in trillions. In fact, I figured it out. Here it is, basic numbers again. 135 of 274 exit polls exceeded the margin of error. Only 14 would have been expected statistically at the 95% confidence level. Of the 135, so the probability of that is zero. Essentially, it's zero. But then you have another fact. 131 of the 135 shifted to the Republicans from the exit poll to the vote. But when you do the joint probability of those two occurrences, you end up with a probability of e to the 116, which is a trillion times a trillion taken 9 times. So it's 100. Oh, geez. Yeah.
It's simply ridiculous to think it could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's so out of the realm. People say, well, what does that mean? And it's when I look at the number, I can't believe it myself. It's beyond. It's more bigger number than there are stars in the universe. Okay,
it's impossible that this was by chance. It was clearly by design. In other words, artificial interference.
Exactly.
By manipulating the voting machines.
Now, you know, the number is so, if it was a 1 in 100,000, that would be a big number. But it's 1 in e to the 1/16th power, or in scientific notation, e to the 1/16 means 115 zeros after the decimal followed by a 1. Okay? Well, okay, so that's the proof. End of story. There's no, it's systemic election fraud. If you say exit polls are not that accurate, well, yeah, there's a margin of error. But at that kind of deviation is totally impossible. And it's anybody could check the calculation.
Now, Richard, there's never been anything wildly like this without voting machines, is there? I mean, they're the key to the theft of these elections, are they not?
Well, yeah, but let me there's a little bit of a story there. Very. Let me be brief. Before the Help America Vote Act in 2002, most votes were counted on paper ballots manually, or let's put it that way, fed through machines, but they were paper ballots, essentially. The problem is that these ballots were spoiled. They were they were thrown away. A classic case of that is Florida in 2000, 185 to 200,000 uncounted votes. So you have uncounted votes that are paper ballots. Now, the worst case is back in 88, 90, 92, 96 elections, when there were 10 million uncounted votes out of about 110 million cast. And the uncounted votes were always favored the Democrats. You've got to figure the Democrats had 75% of the uncounted votes. So that was a major cause of the discrepancy. Of course, there might have been a little machine manipulation going on as well. But people have to be aware of uncounted votes. When the machines, when the voting machines came in mass in 2002, that's when they shifted from spoiling the ballots, throwing away the ballot, to flipping the votes on the voting machines. And of course, you always had your disenfranchisement. Now we're finding out a tremendous amount of voting machines are really not the full story here in Arizona. It's the shifting of the registration or dropping independents from voting and all those manipulations. So that is really what's going on now. Plus, of course, the voting machines. Voting machines are the final, what they finally need after going through all the other manipulations to make sure that they're still in the election.
Now, with these voting machines, by and large, isn't it impossible to do a recount? In other words, you have a black box that gives you a result, and there's no way to verify it.
That is true with the touchscreen machines. With the optical scanners, there is presumably a paper ballot people filled out. They were fed through the servers or the tabulators. But the problem is you can't get to see them. You can't get a recount. So in one case, on the touchscreens, you have absolutely no recourse because there's no, you can't get any paper on the optical scanners. Who knows what they're doing with the ballots, but they won't let you see them. And so effectively, they're one and the same. The optical scanners, you have optical scanners, you have touchscreens. In fact, touchscreens only amount to maybe, I believe, 15% approximately of the total of total machines.
It has long seemed to me, Richard, that if you can't do a recount, it's a fundamentally unconstitutional method of voting, because surely it's the right of a candidate to demand a recount, but it's impossible with these machines.
But the problem is so much more worse than that. Another problem is the candidates don't want recounts. They don't ask for them. So you have, again, what I've come to after many years of being misled into thinking we had a two-party system, which we did, when Kennedy ran, yeah, there were Republicans and there were Democrats. No longer. Both parties are equally guilty. They're two sides of the same coin. So we could say Republicans are stealing votes from the Democrats, but the Democrats are part of it. And they were, as far as I'm concerned, my theory is they're working together. They're working together, whether directly or indirectly, on the in the primaries. Okay. In other words, they're not calling the shots. They're paid for. They're just puppets who just want to get reelected and have lifetime jobs. They're not. There's no such thing as a real Democrat or a real Republican anymore. Maybe Bernie Sanders, to me, is a real Democrat. Of course, they say he's a socialist, but he's really a Democrat. He's one of the few that you're going to find. People are just too scared to speak out. The third rail of American politics is election fraud. The word is never mentioned. Never mentioned. You talk about voter disenfranchisement, but to say anything about voting machines is totally third rail. You'll never hear them say anything about switching the votes. And that's after all these years.
Richard, after our collaborative work on the Wisconsin reelection of Walker over Mary Burke, you know, I submitted our article to a local newspaper, the Cap Times. It actually published an abbreviated version. I was on a local radio show called The Devil's Advocates. And on another local talk show with a fellow named Mitch Hank. But although the evidence was overwhelming, it's as though it fell on deaf ears. I couldn't believe. I explained, for example, how in Milwaukee County, a bastion of Democratic support, you had discovered that the larger the number of votes cast, the greater the percentage that had gone to Walker, which is, of course, simply absurd and prima facie proof that the election was stolen, but I couldn't get any of them to respond to it. It was ridiculous.
I spoke to those guys, too, for about 15 minutes. I don't know. The whole thing about what you're talking about what I call cumulative vote shares, is totally counterintuitive, and it's nothing new. Democrats are in the big counties, Milwaukee, Cook, New York City is all Democratic. Well, that's where they go to steal the votes. This makes common sense. I don't even need to prove it because we know that for a fact, even the adjusted exit polls show that. We know that the big cities are Democratic. So the point is, if you want to steal the election, you can't do it in the small Republican counties because there are no Democrats there. It's very simple. And I spent a week downloading Kentucky, 120 counties. And that was a big deal. I spent too much time downloading and sorting data, accumulating it. All I'm doing is showing what is intuitively what we all know for a fact anyway. So when people, even people today, some people say, well, it doesn't prove anything. For instance, the other day, a guy said on Facebook, he said, oh, your Missouri graph doesn't prove anything. So Hillary did better in St. Louis. Okay. Well, it's true. We're talking here about Democrat versus Democrat. This is the first time I'm doing this. I mean, it's always Democrat versus Republican. But as far as I'm concerned, Hillary Clinton is a de facto Republican. So we are running what I call a conservative, essentially, against a progressive. So the concept should hold that progressive urban area should be going for the progressive candidate. So it's the same analogy, okay? You got to differentiate between the philosophy here, they're both supposedly Democrats. So yeah, the point is well taken. People don't appreciate the that simple fact, and that's all. And you know, that should be obvious by now. But the funny thing is, this phenomenon, I've done so many governor elections with Feingold. I did the Supreme Court 2011, which is coming up now on April 5th. They all show the same pattern. The Republicans steal the votes in Milwaukee County, primarily. There are some other counties, and I've got graphs which show that. But it basically comes down to Milwaukee County, because that's where the bulk of the votes are. And all these elections from 2010, Feingold up until 2014, the recalls, they all show the same thing. So it's, and you would expect that they would. So they're all in confirmation. Other models confirm that as well. It's not just the cumulative vote shares. It's also exit polls and so on and so forth.
So if we have Russ Feingold, who's a bona fide progressive, running against Ron Johnson, who's a mediocre conservative, can we foretell already what's going to happen, what the outcome will be?
Well, I could tell you what the outcome should be and will be, but I can't tell you that it won't be stolen from Russ again. Okay, Russ Feingold, if in a fair election, would probably get upwards of close to 60% of the vote. What I like to do is I compare Russ Feingold to Wyden in Oregon. They're both progressives. Wyden in 2010 won Oregon with 57% in the Senate. Feingold, of course, lost. Now, they're both progressive. They're both in presumably progressive, the two most progressive states, Oregon and Wisconsin. So how could that be? Well, it's obvious that what's going on is you've got a problem in Wisconsin that seems insurmountable, because no matter how well Feingold or any candidate does, Kloppenburg on April 5th, she should win hands down. She did win in 2011. They stole it from her, not just in Waukesha, but also in Milwaukee County, both counties.
Do you want to open that link then, Richard?
Yeah. Let me see if I can. Yeah, this is our first test. All right. Let's see.
Right up at the top.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, just clicked on it. Now, okay. Jesus. Wait a minute.
That's it.
Hold on. No, it's not. I've got it somewhere else here. Wait a minute. Jeez.
Well, you're saying why Kloppenburg
okay, win the yeah, let me, votes. I'm going to have to do it. Yeah, I just want to show the graph. But anyway.
You just have to scroll down, don't you?
Actually, it's on a separate sheet.
Well, there's stuff.
Let me. Just give me a second, okay? It's a little Wisconsin. Let me see if I can. Jesus. Wisconsin Supreme Court. Okay, I'm back to here. Okay, let me go to the true Wisconsin Supreme Court. I hate jumping around like this. I thought I had it, but let me just get the graph here. 2011 Wisconsin cumulative vote shares. Graphs. Okay. Graphs. Let me click on that. Okay. We're going to look at some counties in 2011. Hold on. There it goes. I just put these in one sheet a few hours ago. So I should have done this a long time ago. Anyway, let's take a look at some counties in 2011. I want you to see the pattern. Greene County, well, that looks pretty flat. I mean, except for initially, Kloppenburg was up. Do you see? Wait. Let me share it. Do you see it or no?
Yeah, we're seeing it. We're seeing it.
All right. Okay. You see Kloppenburg up here, close to 60%, coming down. And then she picks up a little bit at the end. But that's not the norm, okay? The norm is more like Brown County. Let me come down.
We can see it.
Yeah, I just want to, I just got to scroll down a little bit. Wait a minute. Yeah. Brown County, you can see what's happening. Prosser's coming up. This county has about 60,000 votes. It's not small. Okay. Let's go to Kenosha County. Kenosha County, 30,000 votes. You can see Kloppenburg coming down. Let's go to St. Croix. Now, St. Croix is interesting. It's almost like perfectly equal all the way through. They superimposed on each other.
That's highly unusual, isn't it, Richard?
Well, but that's a very small county. Again, okay. The small counties are going to be basically parallel. In this case, it's 50% each all the way through, which is what you would expect in a small county. The Republicans don't steal votes in small counties. Okay? Now, Waukesha, now that might look, at first glance, might look parallel, but it's not. You know, you've got 120, 30,000 votes, and you know, although the lines are moving away from each other, so you've got a differential there, which may only be 3 or 4%, but it's significant. It was enough for Prosser to win by 7,000 votes after Kloppenburg was declared the winner. Now, here's another one, which always shows up the same way. Racine County, you see the crossover there. Prosser picks up. It's a 50,000 votes county. Prosser passes Kloppenburg at the 30,000 mark. Then good old Milwaukee County. There it is. Milwaukee County, where Kloppenburg was up around after the first, 20,000 votes? She was up around 75%. And then it's a steady decline as they move into the bigger counties, which, of course, ending up in Milwaukee out here because, you know, that's where well, this is all Milwaukee County, but ending up in the lower than where she started, you know, based on the precinct size. So there you go. And what I'm showing here is really very typical of what you'll see in all the Wisconsin elections. So meaning
once they've honed their method of stealing the election, they stick to it.
Yes. Well, you know, it's they have to. They have no choice. They have to go where the votes are. And the votes are always going to be in Milwaukee County. You know, so they can't change. In other words, they're exposed. They can't go anywhere else. They can't go to a small county with 5,000 voters where they're getting 75% of the vote. They're not going to pick up any Democrats there. So what I found is this very interesting point. In the small counties, and I define small, any of these states, we'll look at the top. If you look at the top 10% of the biggest counties, 10%, top 10 counties, let's say, or top 5 or 10 counties, you'll always see the Republican picking up. But if you go to all the other counties, generally you'll see flat lines, or you might even see the Democrat picking up from a low base. He might only have 35%, but he might go up to 37. So, which means that the Democrat actually they left that count that alone because it didn't amount to much. So you got to focus if they're going to focus on the fraud. What I found very disconcerting is that they're looking at counties that don't mean anything. What's the point of looking at a county with a handful of votes? You want to do a recount of whatever you want to do, auditing. You got to go to the big counties, and that's. You know, they're not doing that. They're not doing it in Kentucky. They should go to the biggest county in Kentucky, but they didn't. They're going to smaller counties. It's like they don't want to confront the issue. Okay? So that's what you run into.
You're saying those who are contesting the outcome aren't actually using the best method to reveal it as
That's
a fraud.
Right. They don't want, you know, they cannot reveal the fraud. It's as simple as that. Once you reveal the fraud, then it becomes front page news, and then you start talking about the voting machines, and then it becomes a big, big story with a lot of legs. Even though, but of course, that's assuming the media will cover it. You know, they know the media is not going to cover anything. So that's where we're stuck. They put all these roadblocks in front of us so that although we know it's clear as day what's going on, we can't get the American people to see the full picture. They continuously do.
So given they're affecting Supreme Court votes and given that they manipulated the recall election for Walker and then his reelection against Mary Burke, that they're going to manipulate these primaries is a given. We already know they're going to interfere.
Well, you know, yes, especially now. We've had 26 primaries. And I'm going to just, I'll leave this on. Well, let me go back to the...
Go back to your homepage, right.
Okay. Being that you're mentioning that, in my analysis, I've tried to be very thorough here. Bernie Sanders wins all the caucuses. He won like 10 or 11 out of 12 caucuses, okay? Actually, you know, it was tied in two of them, supposedly tied the first two in Iowa, Nevada. So he's won... done very well in the caucus. He's averaged 65%. Whereas in the primaries, non-caucuses, he only won 3 out of 20, where he's averaged 41%. So you have a 24% differential in Bernie's share between caucuses and primaries. Now, why?
The primaries are easier to rig than the caucuses.
Absolutely. Caucuses, people are... they're out there, and yeah, they're rigged too, but not to that extent. I believe Nevada and Iowa were rigged. Again, the funny part is, if Hillary wins Iowa by 1% in the caucuses, let's say, they say she won Iowa. Same thing in Nevada. She won Nevada, even though it was tight as you can be. But it's a psychological thing, which Bernie Sanders does not understand. He says, well, but it doesn't really make much difference because you're only looking at the delegate count. Whether he wins Missouri or loses it by 1% or whether he wins it by 1% doesn't make a difference because the delegate count hardly changes. Well, that's where he's wrong because it's not a question so much the delegate count is one thing, but the psychological effect is another. When you say Hillary won 17 of 20 primaries, you're making it appear that she's running away with it. Okay?
Yes.
In fact,
and many of those were extremely narrow victories.
Yes. In fact, matter of fact, I believe that of the 30, well, of those 20, Sanders probably won not three. He probably won 8 or 9 or 10. Now, another thing to keep in mind, Jim, it's not, again, we're talking about padding, vote padding. There's winning the primary and there's vote padding. So did Hillary get 85% of the vote in South Carolina? No, she probably got about 65, but she padded her vote, which padded her delegate count. Okay? So it's a function of psychologically saying you won the state, but then if you win by 85%, wow, that's a landslide. And if you win by 65, that's also a landslide. But there's a big difference in the delegates, right? The delegates are proportional, essentially, to the vote shares. So
Bernie has allowed a lot of opportunities for delegates to slip through his fingers.
Well, you know, in the beginning, I, you know, here's what mystifies me. I understand him not wanting to make a stink after the first two caucuses, okay? Which will, you know, I can understand that. You know, even though we had videos of obvious fraud on the part of the Clinton people, but you know, as we got into Super Tuesday and we're going into the big states, Massachusetts, which of course is the first, which he won. There's no question he won, but they stole that. And then, of course, you go into Missouri and Illinois and Ohio, where he supposedly lost by 10%. I don't believe it. Now we're seeing what really is going on. Arizona has opened the eyes of a lot of people. In other words, a big scam is really the voter registration. I live in Florida. I never voted in a primary in my life. Okay, so I go to vote, and I find out that they won't let me vote because I'm not registered. I'm unaffiliated. I guess I got pissed off at the Democrats at one point a number of years ago. I said, the hell with that. I'm an independent. So I had to go, you know, they could have put me on there and accepted my vote. But after all, I'm a good citizen. I've never been in jail.
Pay your taxes.
I pay my taxes, you know, and so, okay, so I'm unaffiliated. Big deal. Change my registration right now. You've got a computer. Just flip it. I'll become a Democrat. Okay, if that's what it takes to be able to cast my vote. So my wife and I, we couldn't vote. So I'm like a case in point.
Tell us a bit about the history here you have under Wisconsin 2010, Feingold, Walker, SC, Walker recall and all that, just ever so briefly.
Okay. Well, you know, this, I've never been to Wisconsin, okay? I don't know the politics. I know it's a very progressive state, always has been. So I liked Feingold. I felt he was a good guy, a good senator. I knew everybody loved him in Wisconsin, but then he lost that election. And so I figured I'd take a look at the numbers. I looked at the exit polls, and even though I was basically the expo showed a virtual tie. But you know, you can't trust the final exit polls. Anyway, so then of course I got involved. The reason I really got into Wisconsin in a big way was because in the 2011 election, Supreme Court, I posted that it was stolen from Kloppenburg. And that really went viral on Facebook. And all of a sudden, I posted the election integrity group, and which is quiet, you know, basically nobody. But as soon as I posted that, everybody started coming to that group, and groups started forming. I got to say that I had a lot to do with the activism, believe it or not. I don't mean to brag, but
that's good, Richard. People need to understand these things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can speak to a lot of people in Wisconsin. They know me. I'm just this old guy in Florida. But I saw through the 2011 because they felt, well, geez, it was stolen in Waukesha. They found these votes the last minute, whatever her name is. I forget. But I said, look, no, it's not in Waukesha. Yeah, she was able to get the votes from Waukesha. These imaginary votes they found, but the real theft took place in Milwaukee County, and I showed that, and that's really what got me started on this stuff, and why I've spent all my time on a lot of my time either on my blog or on Facebook. You know, I'm in a number of different Facebook groups, election groups. So I basically I feel that everybody should be aware of it. So that's why I'm in at least 10 different groups.
Richard, it was so ridiculous when Walker was being touted as this political giant killer because he'd survived his recall election and then had defeated Mary Burke when we had an historic turnout, which, of course, traditionally favors Democrats, when we'd had Michelle Obama twice, Barack once, and even the big dog himself, Bill Clinton, here. There was tremendous enthusiasm on the Democrat side, and it was simply unbelievable when Walker won that re-election.
Well, I'll say, yes. Okay, it was, you know, regardless of the fact that Obama was there, but Bill Clinton better not show his face there this time, because Bill Clinton is not the Bill Clinton that I knew. Okay, we're finding out a lot of stuff about Bill Clinton that's not, you know, people are very ticked.
Not very flattering.
Yeah, I mean, I voted for Clinton. I mean, I liked the guy up until the very end of his second term. What can I say? I'm very disappointed. I learned a lot. It's more than just Monica Lewinsky.
Oh, sure. It's NAFTA and the WTO, for example.
Yeah, NAFTA. I mean, I worked on Wall Street. I know all about Glass-Steagall because when I was on Wall Street, you had your commercial banks and you had your investment banks, and we were separated by a brick wall.
Right.
And everything was pretty good, you know, in those days. But in the late 80s, things started getting out of hand. And then, of course, Clinton in the 90s got rid of Glass-Steagall, which really was, to me, along with NAFTA, but basically Glass-Steagall was the straw that broke the camel's back, because that is when everything started going to pot. I worked for Merrill Lynch, biggest brokerage firm. We were also an investment bank because we were so big that we had 200 investment bankers. To think that we would be acquired by a commercial bank, and that was long after I left, but to think that they would become acquired was unthinkable. The biggest brokerage firm on Wall Street, okay, was acquired by, I forget the commercial bank, one of the big banks. I don't know. So that fouled everything up. At that point, they went crazy. The bankers really got control, and the investment banks became just, I don't even know it. They're no longer really investment banks. Let's put it that way.
Well, Richard, it required such a high degree of corruption to discount Glass-Steagall to allow all this to happen. I mean, it was truly outrageous of a corrupt, absolutely corrupt Congress. And I think it was Phil, what's his name, from Texas, who had a key part to play in this.
Yeah, I don't remember who, but yeah, it was it covered in the heart of our economic system. I mean, which was corrupt. It's telling me my internet connection is unstable.
No, keep going. You're fine. You're fine.
Yeah, and that's really a primary. Well, and Clinton knew what he was doing. See, when Clinton was going, he came in as a so-called liberal, but then the strategy was, hey, look, I'll move to the center because I want to get the Republicans in with me. You know, I want to really get a tremendous majority. And by so doing that, he ruined the Democratic Party, in effect, it became too close
muddled.
To Republicans.
It became muddled.
Yeah, muddled. I mean, you know, Clinton won by landslides, bigger than that than you people know. But you know, that three-way.
But were even those victories illegitimate?
Oh yes, absolutely. You had Perot in both elections. Perot had 18-20%. In 92, Clinton supposedly had only 43% and Bush 37. But the unadjusted polls and my analysis shows Clinton had about 51-52%. So Bush had only 30%. He didn't have, it wasn't so close. It was like 50, 30 to 20, round numbers. So, and then in 96, Perot had, what, 8, 10%. Clinton did much better than is reported. Every Democrat has since 1988. Even Dukakis may have won in 88. There were 11 million uncounted votes. Dukakis lost by 7 million recorded votes to Poppy Bush. I think Dukakis won that election. He won the he won the exit polls. That was theft of a grand order. But people, you know, they Bush. There's never been a Bush winning a fair election. I'll say that right now.
That's fascinating. And you think perhaps his background as former director of the CIA helped here, that he knew how to steal elections because he'd been done abroad so many times?
I wouldn't be surprised if that was a factor. You know, I was interviewed last week by Bob Fitrakis. You must know Bob.
Sure,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we were talking about that. Bob is he's very funny. He's very good. And he brought up the same thing. Bush's CIA background. He says, I wonder if that had anything to do with it. I said, yeah, I think it may have.
Richard, let's look at your home here on the primaries. You're talking about in 2008, the Republicans wanted to run against Hillary. And in 2016, they want to run against Hillary again. Yeah. Tell us about Operation Chaos.
Okay. Well, it's in my blog. I've got the blog post, but somebody could read up on it. I was into the 2008 primaries very deep, very deep. I did a lot of work on that. I was really for Obama then, at that time. And I saw, well, it started out in New Hampshire primary. He was way ahead in all the polls. He actually won the exit polls. But she got the recorded vote the night before. She supposedly picked up all these voters. So right away, I'm saying there's something wrong here. And people still don't understand. Obama won the paper ballots. And she won the machine count. But I started following 2008 all the way through. And, of course, the Republicans wanted Hillary to run. They didn't want to run against Obama. So Rush Limbaugh came up with the scheme, let's go and vote for Hillary. So a lot of Republicans voted for Hillary Clinton, and she won some primaries. And and there are other anomalies. I've got it all in my blog post. Anybody could take a look at it.
But Richard, this year things are very, very strange. They may still want to run against Hillary. Sanders is doing well. Why would they not want to run against Sanders? And who would they? Didn't they think it was going to be Jeb versus Hillary?
I assume they did, but of course Jeb just he was
he couldn't cut it.
Trump took care of him real good about 9/11. I mean, yes. Of course, Jeb said, well, my brother kept us safe.
Right.
Yeah, he kept us safe. Yeah. Well, we won't go into 9/11.
Right, but the greatest terrorist attack of the history.
I know all about 9/11, but we won't talk about that. The point is, Trump has really messed things up for the Republicans. They don't know how to deal with this guy. So I like Trump. I mean, I'll just say this. I like Trump. I think a lot of what he says is just posturing to, you know, he likes to be dramatic. I don't believe he's a bigot. I believe he probably would be a damn good president. And people don't realize he's just the kind of guy who basically says, look, he'll say what he has to say to get into office. But I do not believe that he would do the things he said, some of the things he says. I don't believe he's a bigot. I don't believe he's a bigot.
He committed a colossal blunder this morning by having an interview with Chris Matthews, who was pushing him about if abortions were illegal, should women who undergo them be punished? And he got Trump to say, eventually, well, yeah, there should be some kind of punishment, which then became great news. Now he's been attacked by the left and the right, and he's walked it back with a formal statement. But it was very, very...
I know. I heard about that. I didn't see the interview, but quite frankly, he said things that were not necessary. He really, you know, this guy could have really been a viable candidate. I think he still is. Obviously, he's winning everything, but he said some things which were not necessary.
Yeah.
And he, which I know he doesn't believe.
Yeah.
He says, well, I'm not, I love Israel. My daughter is Jewish, you know. She said she just had a beautiful Jewish baby. So he's trying to tell us, well, he's not bigoted because he's got his daughter's converted to Judaism. So, okay, but I don't believe he hates Muslims. I really don't. I mean,
no, of course not.
You know, so whatever he said, he didn't have to be, he's trying to be so dramatic. I don't know. The guy just oversteps. When I like him. Believe me, I would never vote for Hillary Clinton. If she runs against him, I'm going to vote for him.
No, yes, me okay. Too.
All right.
Hillary's a disgrace on many different counts.
Oh, jeez.
So this Ted Cruz guy, what do you make of him?
Well, I tell you the truth, I really don't pay much attention to him. I don't like – I watched a few of the debates, but I – quite frankly, all the Republicans turned me off, except maybe Rand Paul. Okay, but he didn't get anywhere. Kasich wasn't that bad, but Cruz and Rubio. I mean, Rubio strikes me as just he's like a kid, you know. I mean, he's not. I guess he's in his late 30s or whatever. But you know, he's not qual. And, you know, the things they come out with, I don't like the over – what can I say? I like to keep religion out of things. You know, it's a lot of hypocrisy. I mean, now we're hearing about Cruz's sex life. I don't really care.
Well, the reason it matters is he's offered himself as paradigm of morality and an evangelical Christian, Richard.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But, and there's a lot more coming out. I mean, this is actually going to do in his campaign. So I don't expect Cruz to be around 2 weeks from now.
You know, John F. Kennedy was one of the, just like Clinton, except Kennedy, for some reason, I didn't care that Kennedy had affairs. Kennedy was a good guy.
Yes.
And so he had affairs we didn't really know about. We heard rumors. And the guy, he took after his father. He just, any woman he'd get a hold of, he would. But he didn't rape anybody, as far as I know.
I mean,
although he got a lot of Hollywood actresses,
he didn't even fly Marilyn across the country to.
Yeah, right. There was a lot, you know, he had a bunch of, but the point is, you know, I don't mind it. It's like, all right.
Yeah.
You know, but when you hear some stories about other things going on, like I hate to say it, like Clinton, some of the stories, you know, Roger Stone wrote the book.
Well, Richard, Roger Stone has a book about it. He was actually thrown out of Oxford for raping a fellow student.
Yeah, right. I think I remember that. The difference is, you know, what really just, I'm 73. And I've followed all the elections since 52. And Kennedy was in a class by himself. In fact, Eisenhower was pretty damn good in retrospect also at that time. But these guys make Dick Nixon look like a god. Dick Nixon was a god compared to these guys. And I hated Dick Nixon.
I know, isn't that ridiculous?
These guys make Nixon look good. Yeah, I mean, I know Roger Stone worked for Nixon.
Yeah.
And when Roger and I got together in Fort Lauderdale, it was a wonderful lunch. We exchanged books. He was just – and I said, you know, Roger, you worked for Nixon. You were doing the dirty tricks, you know. I said, I don't even know why I'm here talking to you. And he said, well, yeah, you're right, but, you know, you have to do what you have to do to win. And I love Roger. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. You know, I'm a big fan of Roger also, Richard.
Yeah, him and I are similar. I'm coming from the left. He's coming from the right. We're meeting in the middle. Okay? And so he doesn't like the hypocrisy. I don't like it. That's the worst thing I see, hypocrisy. And if he's...
That's why the sex business is going to do in Cruz.
Yeah.
But the lawyer for Palfrey, the D.C. madam, says he has information that will affect this election and that it needs to be unbound. It's been sealed by the court. He's asking them to unseal it. And he's stating that if the court won't unseal it, he'll regard the order to keep it sealed as void and release it as a matter of national security that the public needs to know. And my conviction, Richard, is it's going to show that Ted Cruz was one of her patrons.
Ted Cruz is the least of it.
Yeah. I know. Many others, you know. Yeah.
But, of course, it's unfortunate the woman committed suicide.
Well, After saying she'd never commit suicide, Richard.
Yeah, I know. It just so happens.
These murders are so blatant right in our face.
Yeah, yeah. I was watching again about Vince Foster yesterday. Yes. And, of course, I remember that. I remember, for some things I have a good memory. The night Vince Foster was killed, okay? Well, they say he committed suicide. I don't believe it. But I was watching Larry King. And who was he interviewing that evening? Bill Clinton was being interviewed by Larry King, the same, just when they were finding the body, okay?
Yeah.
It was that same day. I'll never forget it. Yeah. Wow. So
Vince was killed in an office, rolled up in a rug, and taken out to the park to be found.
Right. The evidence.
I did a show on it relatively recently. That he was murdered is beyond any doubt. That Hillary was involved is overwhelmingly probable.
Yeah. It's the evidence is all in one direction. It's a big cover up. I don't know. I guess we got a little off the topic here, but.
Well, no, we're talking about the campaign and the key players, including, of course, Hillary. And I don't know. The Republicans don't seem to be willing to accept the very idea of Trump being their candidate.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's like the DNC can't accept anything but Hillary being their candidate. So the Republicans, I don't know what they're going to do, but they're trying to make it very difficult for Trump. And unfortunately for Trump, he can't call the shots. They'll do what they want to do. So, you know, how's he going to fight it? They have a brokered convention. I don't know. I mean, if they're all against you, how do you win?
They want to give it to someone like Matt Romney, for God's sake, and Paul Ryan.
Oh yeah, well,
Romney. I mean, it's just a disgrace.
I know. It's absolutely. It's. This is the worst election that I think I've ever seen. But in a way, it's all to the good, because what we're seeing is, in graphic terms, the corruption is right out there, and I don't think the Democratic Party will ever recover from this. We still know what's going to happen to Hillary Clinton as far as the email investigation. I don't know. But the Democrats have to be wondering just what the hell they're going to do now, because how is Clinton going to run with all this baggage?
And the Republicans are in a similar situation. It's the greatest chaos I've ever seen in the American political system. And I've got 2 years on you, Richard. You're just a kid.
Yeah, I'm just a kid.
This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guest, Richard Charnin, for being here. I'd love to have you back, Richard. We'll do it again.
Anytime.
Stand by for the new JFK show. We'll be right back.
Okay. Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
All right, welcome to the new JFK show number 97, where we're going to tie up some loose ends concerning the Sitka attack on Dr. Fetzer. It's been nothing but a merciless TKO from one end to the other. Then we're going to turn it over to Larry Rivera with some new research as usual. But right now, we've at the Oswald Innocence Campaign website, there's quite a few new people that's been inducted to the OIC or been joining the OIC. So, Larry, go ahead and give us an update on that, and then we're going to turn it over to Dr. Fetzer and tie up some loose ends.
Thank you, Gary. Well, you know, I'm happy to announce that we've got some three very outstanding people joining the OIC, starting, of course, with the Michael Parenti, who's written 24 books, more than 500 articles, PhD from Yale. His article from 1996, The Gangster State, is still relevant today, and it deals with the JFK assassination and all of the problems that those who still think that the Oswald acted alone. We've got Professor David Caban from Tampa, Florida, who's also a professor and who's done a lot of research and a lot of education on the JFK assassination. And Richard Shattuck, an ex-Marine, computer consultant, U.S. military, and NSA computer skills specialist, who's done a lot of work with the Pentagon and staffers there, and who's run a couple of websites, ajkat.org and jfktruth.org. And I just wanted to make the public aware of these three additions to the OIC, and I'll just turn it over to Jim right now so we can get started.
Well, that's great, Larry. Those are terrific ads. Everyone should visit the homepage of the Oswald Innocence Campaign, where they can see how many outstanding scholars and students of JFK subscribe to the proposition of Lee Oswald's innocence of the assassination of JFK insofar as he was on the front doorway of the book depository observing the motorcade as it took place, which means that he could not only not have been the lone demented gunman, but he could not possibly have even been one of the shooters. So today we're going to do a few odds and ends left over. You see here the introduction that I've been using for each of our responses to G. Eugenio. If we move forward to, this is just about part one. But of course, we've covered part one and part two in a seven-part series. So this is number eight as an add-on. And where in particular, in the second paragraph, he talks about Chauncey Holt having reported in a radio interview that he was a counterfeiter who worked for the CIA in 1963, that he was ordered to bring actually 15 sets of false Secret Service identification at Dealey Plaza, that he disguised himself as one of the three tramps in the famous photographs of the so-called hobos who, after being unloaded from a train car, were escorted through Dealey Plaza on the way to police headquarters. But he made a remark in passing, Larry, of particular interest about the idea that Chauncey should have been in New Orleans with Lee Oswald, and yet we have photographic proof that that was indeed the case. Would you like to talk about this photograph?
Yes, indeed. This is a classic. This is a screen capture from a video of Lee Oswald passing out leaflets there in front of the trademark there in New Orleans. And to the right is Chauncey Holt. And we're going to look at a couple more slides. To the left, we see the famous Asian man, you know, with the akimbo pose there with both hands at his shoulders. Okay. And Lee Oswald, you know, in his necktie and everything, you know, passing out leaflets, very visible there, you know, downtown, and very happy.
For the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
That's right, for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee there. And as we know, later on, you know, he had that big fracas and altercation with Carlos Bringuier and his friends there, where they ended up being arrested and taken in to the New Orleans Police Department and booked.
And it was remarkable, although the fracas only lasted a minute and a half or so. They got it on TV.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly. That's what really is so remarkable about these encounters here with Lee Oswald being sheep-dipped, as Jim Garrison so eloquently stated in New Orleans. You know, creating this legend of being a communist. You know, pro Castro, where in reality he was quite the opposite.
Chance. There we go.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this next slide. This man here, and who is passing right in front of the camera. If we've done some extensive analysis here, and the face has been obscured. Okay. And there's a couple of more images that we're going to show here. But basically, this man looks remarkably similar to
Michael Payne.
Michael Payne, exactly, and we've inserted an image, you know, for comparison, and we're gonna, you know, look at the next couple of slides where, you know, if there was a problem, you know, with this image or with this film, then why obscure the face of the man? Okay, it's very obvious if you look closely at the eyes and the face that some kind of mechanism here has been put in here to obscure his face, you know, some kind of ink or you know.
The fellow has an unusually shaped skull, as did Michael Payne.
Yeah.
The eyebrows and all that, it looks to me as though that is indeed who this party is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I first started looking at this, yeah, and then here, he's got like these little squiggly lines coming down his face, you know, where it seems like it's been airbrushed, you know, and then we did more comparisons with more other images of Michael Payne, and it seems like, you know, it's him. You know, I'm not going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, absolutely 100% that it's him, but, you know, why would the face be obscured is my point here, you know, so.
Oh, I think it's a very good bet. I'd say it's 90 to 10 at least that this is Michael Payne, probably actually higher.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And of course, Chauncey Holt himself identified himself in this footage here on the right there, Jim.
Yes. And of course,
yeah, don't forget, this was the days when to get someone on television, you had to take out these cameras that weighed hundreds of pounds. It wasn't like today where you could just have it in the palm of your hand.
That's right. That's right.
It's a big deal to get someone on television.
Yeah, yeah. These were huge. They were huge pieces of equipment that had to be mobilized in order to, you know, get this down like this.
There we go. I was having trouble with my advance here. So, but there we have it. The point is, here I'm going to talk briefly about the number of times JFK was hit, because it seemed as though D. Eugenio didn't understand what we know about it, which include, of course, being hit in the back from in the front from the triple underpass, actually the second hit, the first hit coming from in the back from the county records building, and then after the limousine is brought to a halt, he's hit in the back of the head from the Dow Tech, slumps forward. Jackie eases him back up, looking him right in the face when he's hit in the right temple from the right front by that frangible exploding bullet that blows his brains out the back of his head. And while we know a lot about all of these, I mean, it's, you know, I've gone through this before, but I want to do a brief review just to confirm for the show. Shot in the back, the hole in the jacket, 5.5 inches below the collar at a downward angle. There's a shirt. David Manding actually had a member of the staff put on the shirt and the jacket, and the hole in the shirt is ever so slightly below the hole in the jacket, just as you would expect if it had been fired from a downward angle. Here's, of course, the autopsy diagram by J. Thornton Boswell, where you can see that mark on the back below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column, on the left and again on the right, where the right version has been authenticated by Admiral George Berkeley, who was JFK's personal physician. So you can't claim there were holes in the shirt and the jacket, but not in the body, because the holes in the shirt and the jacket correspond to the hole in the body. Here we have Siebert's diagram showing the wound to the back was below any damage to the throat. And, of course, what they were seeing at the Bethesda of the throat looks as though it was a considerable enlargement of what we had from Charles Crenshaw, to which we shall turn momentarily. And here we have, you know, Merkley's own death certificate stating that JFK had been killed by a shot to the head, and that a second wound occurred at the posterior back at about the level of the third thoracic vertebrae, where it turns out that the third thoracic vertebrae is in the same place. As I've explained, those who want to claim JFK's jacket was bunched up so that the shots in the shirt and the jacket didn't show where they actually were on the body are thereby refuted. And here, of course, we had the stand-in for JFK when the Warren Commission staff did its reconstruction, ironically using the Secret Service Cadillac rather than the Lincoln limousine, which vitiated its forensic significance. But notice, even the Warren Commission staff was convinced that JFK had been hit in the back. That's that large patch. And then, of course, in the back of the head by the much smaller patch. Now, if we turn, so we've established he was hit in the back, that number one. Here we have the diagrams from Charles Crenshaw, which I published in Assassination Science in 1998, showing the original wound, which was a small, clean puncture wound, obviously a wound of entry, versus on the right, after Malcolm Perry, MD, had performed a simple straight-line tracheostomy incision right through the hole in the throat. But where we encounter this in autopsy diagrams, where it's been greatly enlarged, and where Bob Livingston, MD, who is a scientific director of the National Institutes for Mental Health and of Neurological Diseases and Blindness, where the building of the National Institute for Health was across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he had called Commander Humes, who was in charge of the autopsy earlier in the day, to explain that he'd heard the description of the throat wound. And since it was he was an expert on wound ballistics, having supervised an emergency medical hospital during the Battle of Okinawa for Japanese prisoners of war and injured Okinawans, he knew that was clearly an entry wound. And thus he told Humes it was particularly important he should dissect the neck very carefully, because if there were any evidence of shots from behind, then they would know there had been at least two shooters and therefore a conspiracy. Instead, what happened was Humes called Livingston later to ask what the throat wound would look at if it had been an accident, and Livingston gave him a description, which Humes appears to have used to alter the wound to make it look more like it was a wound of exit. This is all.
And a bad wound of exit, because if you look at Volt's wounds of exit, Jim, they are usually uniform in their exit pattern. They're not in the horizontal, jagged pattern that we see in this image that you see here. Also, I very briefly wanted to also add that regarding the shot in the back, Marty Schatz, in his book History Will Not Absolve Us, one of his main it's a book that where he compiles letters to Vincent Salandria and just throwing out basic information that totally contradicts the Alona theory. And he one of his main arguments here was the exact what you were just mentioning about the back wound and the shot, the way it is aligned in the shirt and the jacket, and how it was impossible to that shot to have come out of the throat just by looking at the line coming from the Texas School Book Depository, had it come from the sixth floor, the southeast corner of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. And that's, you know, just basically what Marty Schatz is. He's a psychiatrist who wrote a book, like I said, History Will Not Absolve Us.
Yes.
And that's one of the main arguments that he puts forth in that book.
Yeah, I met Marty and Vince in Boston. We had a very pleasant afternoon conversation. But it's very clear here that, you know, Humes had never dealt with a gunshot victim before, nor had J. Thornton Boswell, so that they didn't do it well because they didn't know what they were doing, Larry. They were using the information Bob Livingston had provided to Humes to alter, but they did it in a messy, very amateurish way. So we got this ridiculous result.
And in previous programs, we have determined that it was most probably John Liggett who did this hatchet job there at his throat.
Well, I've always thought it was Liggett who reconstructed the ear. I'd never been persuaded that he was involved in the throat, but he may have been. You believe that Liggett actually messed with the throat? You would think Liggett, who was so skilled with a scalpel, would have done a better job than this.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be the best.
And, of course, about the blowout at the back of the head, David Mantic established using his optical densitometry studies already in November, December of 1992, that the lateral cranial X-ray, the X-ray of JFK's skull taken from the right side, which you see on the left, had been altered by Area P, a patch involving material that was much too dense to be human bone, or by exposure to a bright light to create the same effect, where we know this was a blowout from a bullet that entered the right front. Here we can actually see the blowout in frame 374, which the perps and their at Hawkeye work, the secret CIA lab adjacent to Godak headquarters in Rochester, New York, overlooked, that you can actually see the blowout. Where the pinkish part, of course, is the skull flap that's blown open. And then the grayish matter, we've all heard the reference to gray matter, is the exposure where there's some part of the scalp hanging down, but it's a very close proximity. And where we know, of course, when you compare earlier frames, that they blacked out the blowout at the back of the head in frames on the left. And here on the right, of course, you're looking at frame 374. Where David also discovered this trail of particles indicative of the second shot to the head that was with a frangible or exploding bullet, so that we had the entry at the right temple that actually set up shockwaves that blew the brains out the back of the already weakened skull, because the Bethesda pathologists had noticed there was an entry wound in the vicinity of the external occipital protuberance, which David has confirmed. But where the HSCA astoundingly would move it upward 4 inches to the top and completely conceal the blowout at the back of the head. And here we got Thomas Evan Robinson, the mortician who spent more time with the body than anyone else, confirming several of these wounds. The large gaping hole in the back of the head, the small wound in the right temple, talks about the skull flap. 3 inches, approximately two small shrapnel wounds in the face packed with wax, which David brilliantly inferred were caused by shards of glass when the bullet that hit him in the throat passed through the windshield. Here's confirmation of the wound in the back, 5 to 6 inches below the shoulder to the right of the backbone, that adrenaline glands and brain were removed, other organs removed and put back, but no swelling or discoloration to the face, meaning that he died instantly. So we really don't have a lot of room for argument about JFK having been hit 4 times in the back from behind, in the throat from in front, in the right temple from in front. And then what everyone confirms, that the Bethesda physicians actually had right, that he was hit in the back of the head, which David Mantic has confirmed. So those are the 4 hits I've described, where David believes there may be evidence of yet a 5th shot to JFK, but where anyone who wants to understand needs to realize that JFK was hit at least 4 different times. Then there were at least 3 rounds that missed, one that missed and hit a distant curbing and injured James Tang, another that missed and wound up in the grass where it was picked up by a lieutenant, a third that missed, fired from behind, that hit the chrome strip over the... So that's 4 plus 3 is 7. Then Connolly, 1 to 3 times, 8, 9, 10. And if there was yet another shot to the head, that would be 11, and if there was yet another miss fired from the top of the county records building, 12. That would be my take on the max. Then we find, with this part two, he goes on and on with his attacks. And Larry, here I think we're talking about, some photographic evidence you'd like to discuss.
Yeah, this is the Alton's...
letter.
Yeah. What? I'm sorry. I did not see this image before.
Hey, Dr. Fetzer, wasn't the sign hit several times as well?
Well, yes, the sign does seem to have been hit in addition, Gary. So you make a point that there could be, therefore, even a larger number than 12. 12 sounds like a large number, but it may actually have been
14, 15.
The sign was hit more than once, even 14. Mm-hmm. This is talking about the shirt. The shirt worn the day of the assassination. I think we must be talking about Billy here.
Yeah. This is sort of like off topic here.
Yeah, I think I may have this in the wrong order, Larry. We can move forward here you're identifying many different areas in which the Alchin's six has been altered. And because there's so much here, I broke it into two parts so you could talk about each of the parts separately.
Yes, of course. This is the Saturday Evening Post version of the Alchin 6 photograph, which was published on December 14, 1963. This was the very first time that, and I would have to say, quote unquote, the entire photograph was published, because the night of the assassination and Saturday after the 23rd, only extremely cropped versions of the photograph were published. Now, the very first time that the entire, and again, this is a hypothetical, you know, because I believe this photograph extended more upwards as a photograph would have, you know, of this type of quality
Showed more of the facade of the book.
Yeah, would have shown more of the, based on the quality.
And the tree, maybe they wanted to obfuscate the tree because it provided an obstacle in between the sixth floor alleged shooting lair and the target.
I agree. And I believe somebody in the OIC had stated that one of our new members stated that photograph should have shown, like you say, a lot more. And the upper portions of the photograph, the upper portions of the Texas School Book Depository building. And because if you look at the photograph, it looks like more horizontal. And in fact, you know, this type of photograph would have been more square. And basically, in this quadrant of the photograph that we're looking at here, towards the left, you see areas that were never published before. And I'm talking about the... Two circles. There's a oval to the left and a circle, which we see obvious ink blotches. Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this. And I believe we have already spent some time talking about.
I wanted to go back to this, Larry, because Di Eugenio and others seem to think there was no opportunity to alter the Alchin 6, and yet it's been massively altered in many different ways. I mean,
These are very obvious, Jim. I know exactly. If you look at Emery Roberts, you know, you look at the windshield, you know, the way, you know, the tint is totally amorphous. You know, it is not the regular line that you see in a tinted glass, you know, in a windshield. And then we're not even going to talk about the doorway, but excluding that area, you know, when you look at Emery Roberts here and the two splotches on the left, you know, it's pretty obvious, you know, that this photograph has been altered. And then if you look at the next slide, which shows the right portion of the photograph quickly here. Yeah. For example, Dennis Camino has identified, if you look in the white vehicle behind LBJ's car, which was a Secret Service detail, the door has been open. They are already reacting. But if you look inside, if you try to look inside of the vehicle, the faces of the occupants of the vehicle have been also obscured. I mean, why would that happen? Why would that be the case? And then you have also other areas, for example, stairway, you know, the fire escape there, you know, on the Dow Tux building, where there's an area there where the window that we know of. And then above that, you know, and you cannot see it here in this version, because there's another version that shows higher up. There was a black man there on the stairway, and there is an area that, that obscures part of his legs there. And then more, if you go further down, you know, at LBJ's car, where Rufus Youngblood was sitting, you can see that parts of his face have been obscured. The right fender of the vehicle, there's a black splotch there. And then a spectator there, right there in the middle, and this was also done by Dennis Camino, at the top left, has been obscured there as well. So if just by looking at these basic shapes that we see in the Alton 6 photograph, how can you say that it has not been altered when these are very obvious cases of alteration?
I think he's just displaying his utter incompetence, and he knows nothing about photography or alteration, and really has never studied the subject. Look at how many times he was coming after me about Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, the Holocaust, what have you, where he knew nothing whatsoever about the subject. I mean, to me, it's just the height of arrogance to be attacking somebody for research you have never read and do not understand.
Well,
go ahead, Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
No, I was just saying that I just can't believe that DiEugenio gave up his credibility over the Boston Marathon and Sandy Hook. I mean, those have been researched beyond a shadow of a doubt. So I don't, like you said, I don't think he'll ever recover from this myself.
Well, this slide shows a close-up of the left side of the Saturday Evening Post version of the Alton 6, and we have outlined the obvious, so very obvious areas of obfuscation and ink splotches that have been placed here on the extant version of the photograph. And if you look at the woman there where the red arrow, it seems that she has a camera at face level, okay?
Yeah.
And for some reason, that camera has been obscured, and you can see very clearly that there's a hand strap, okay? And when we look at those same women from the other side, from the Zapruder's point of view, and this is looking at the Zapruder frame, the Zapruder film, and these splotches obviously are not there. These are exactly the same women, but looked at from the opposite way from, like I said, from which Zapruder's point of view would have been. Now these women, obviously, I think both of them had cameras, okay? And the woman has been identified as Maggie Brown from the Dallas Morning News. She and her co-workers, okay, Aurelia Alonso and a couple of the other women, they went down and they were there at the north curb of Elm Street. And what really intrigues me is the one on the right, Jim, because this one has really been obscured. I mean, the ink splotch is a lot bigger, okay? And it seems to me that the only reason that they would have done anything like this is because they were filming the assassination or taking pictures. Now, direction...
And Larry, just to be more precise... She would have captured Lyndon ducking down in his vehicle.
Exactly. That's what I was just going to mention. The line of sight of her position there, you know, she does not have her camera trained on JFK. She has her camera trained on LBJ and his car. When you look at the entire photograph, in the complete version of the photograph, you can see that it's very clear that her line of sight and, you know, what she would have been filming would have been LBJ. And that obviously would have contained, you know, what LBJ was doing at the time of the assassination.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Here's the next. This is a close-up of the Secret Service of
Emory Roberts.
Yeah, the man in charge.
This is the same Emory Roberts who called off Henry Ripka at Love Field, okay?
And the other agent, right, left the
That's
two
right.
behind. And then when John Reddy started to respond in Dealey Plaza, he called him back.
That's right. And so this is the same Emory Roberts who later on some people think that he later on committed suicide. You know, apparently he had was very remorseful for what he did or what he did not do.
Well, he was a very nasty piece of work. He was an absolutely crucial player to bringing about the assassination in terms of its actual execution in Dealey Plaza.
I agree. I agree. And anybody who looks at this blow up here, Jim, and does not come out with the idea that this man, that this image here has been obfuscated, you know, I don't know what the heck that they're thinking and what they're looking at, because...
Well, Larry, you got some people who look at the doorway area, and you got a man whose face has been scraped off, and they say there's no alteration. You got a man who's missing his left shoulder. You got a man who's in front of and behind him at the same time. You got a man whose face has been blacked out, and they claim they can't see any evidence of alteration. I mean, what are we dealing with? What is the level of intelligence here?
Yeah, yeah. And again, this was originally circulated by, again, Dennis Camino, you know, who's extremely perceptive.
Yeah, Dennis is completely brilliant at this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I know you want to talk about the Alchin 7, Larry, so go for it.
Yeah, yeah, Alchin 7, I just wanted to first mention that Jack White was very public about all four images, photographs by Ike Alchin's being altered in one way or another, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And this is the first image here is what is supposed to be the contact print, okay, of the of his
You're talking about the top left.
Yeah, the first 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 at the bottom. Okay, now usually contact prints are uniform, you know, they're one after another. This one, as you can see, they've been cut up, you know, and they've been reassembled.
Right, they've been segmented.
Exactly.
This is not a continuous roll as you'd have in an ordinary contact sheet.
Exactly. And number 7 at the bottom, if you look at the top right, this is the uncropped version of, well, what is the extant, which extant means surviving, a version of the Alchin 7. If you look at the top right, you can see that it's very obvious that the cement railing has been chopped off at the top.
Yes.
Okay, now why would that be? Okay, now, you know, once we start getting into that, then, you know, there's a lot of situations here that we can come up with. Now, number 8, I just wanted to go a little bit, the time difference between number 8 on the right, which would be the...
second row on the right.
That's right, second row on the right, okay? And number 7 and number 6, there seems to have been a lot of time difference in the time frame is when Alchin snapped these pictures. As Alchin's being a professional photographer, you know, he would have been trained to snap pictures off continuously.
Right. Quick.
Exactly.
A historic event like this, you don't want to miss anything.
Exactly. So right away, I'm looking at, and we're going to make some comparisons now with the Zapruder film, you know, as far as, you know, photographs that he should have, it seems like he would have been taking, but snapping, but, you know, they don't seem to be in the record at all. So if we go on to the next slide here, we can zip right through this. Yeah, here. This is Zapruder frame, 349 or something like that. Anyway, you can see that Alchin seems to be taking a picture here at the time where Clint Hill is starting to get into the JFK limo. Okay, and to the right we see Malcolm Summers, who
that's Alchin's above Jackie.
That's right. Alchin's is right about above Jackie, and to the left of him is Jim Botham. Both of them were professional photographers, okay? And right there at the bottom, right of Alchin's, left of him, you know, if we would have been facing us, is Malcolm Summers, which we spoke about then when we did the Blink Rate program. Remember, we did that short where we determined that he had he dove to the right and reincorporated himself into a squat in only 11 frames, which would have been impossible based on Roy Schaefer's research. Okay, but coming back to here, we're looking at Alchin's what it seems to be snapping a photograph. If we go on to the next slide, I think we can get a better perspective. Yeah, right here. Okay, where he seems to be snapping a photograph right there, which would have shown the grassy knoll. Okay, and this isn't even, we're not even starting to see him snapping Alton 7, because Alton 7, he shot from behind the
right.
limb. Right. Okay. So what I'm trying to establish here is that the Altons probably shot maybe one, even two additional photographs.
Which
were probably
at a time would have provided enough opportunity.
Yes. Based on the background and everything that we have established here, and again, if you look at Malcolm Summers, and we dealt with this in
not to mention Blankery. Larry, that the limo stop would have given him so many opportunities.
That's right.
This is extremely
true.
Suspicious.
He might have
taken a whole sequence about the stop and Bobby Hargis dismounting and running between the limo and the secret agent surrounding the president and taking the piece of skull from the little boy, throwing it in the back, and Officer Douglas motoring up the side of the grassy knoll
until his
bike fell over. How could you miss that?
That's right. So there is a reason for this, and that's why when we look at the frames that are missing, especially when you look at the reaction of Malcolm Summers, which we dealt with, like I said, in the Blink Rate show that we did a few weeks ago, then it really becomes clear why they would have removed these frames, because they would have shown Ike Alton's taking additional photographs.
There's one of the yellow stripes freshly painted on the concrete to define the kill zone.
Exactly. Yeah. So then this is an enlargement here of Alton 7, and as we mentioned before, the top right of the photograph where has been chopped off, which would have shown the cement railing. And you have been up there, we've been up there many times, and you know that I don't know what reason there would have been to remove that portion of the photograph, but who was there? What were they trying to remove there and obfuscate?
Larry, I've long believed this could even be a completely fabricated photograph. What's your take about it?
Yeah. Well, another thing that I wanted to mention briefly here is based on the Newcomb tapes, Harry Freeman stated clearly that he was in between the lead car and the JFK limo, okay? Now, you look at this photograph, and he's nowhere to be seen here, okay? And he was very specific about his position being right in front of the JFK limo off of the front bumper and right behind the lead car. And we're going to go a little bit into the what's really going on in the lead car in a couple of frames here, a couple of slides here. But that's very interesting what you just pointed out, because Harry Freeman, stated that his position was right in between those two cars, and he's not visible here at all.
Yeah, I have to really look at this picture in a suspicious way, because they're about to hit the curb. And that would have probably thrown Jackie and Clint Hill right off the back of the car. You can see they're about to hit the curb really hard.
Well, it seems like they're right in the middle of the road here.
It's a very strange photograph.
Yeah, they're about to hit the curb, though. You can tell.
Now this is a composite that I did of a photograph that shows the upper right-hand portion of the Alton 7, comparing it to another photo taken that day that shows what has been chopped off of the Alton 7 photograph. Okay, so it's pretty obvious that there was something going on there in that area that they did not want to be preserved, for the record there, Jim. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the flag, the JFK, the presidential flag that was flying on the limousine. Okay, if you look at the fringe, and this is important because what we're going to talk about now in the next couple of slides is very relevant to this. These flags had a fringe, a decorative fringe, which bordered the flag itself. Okay, and the next slide, please. We're just gonna look at the three different Alton's photographs show the flag. Alton's 5 shows the right side of the flag. Alton's 6 shows the left side of the flag, and they both have the presidential seal. Okay, and the circle around the seal. Okay, now the Alton 7 doesn't show anything. Okay, it seems like it's been blacked out in some way. All right, so yeah. I believe this is very, very significant for what we're going to talk about next here. Let's go on to the next. Now, this is a blow-up of the lead car, all right? And it shows, first of all, very obvious that both of the brake lights are on, okay, which would have meant that Chief Curry, Jesse Curry, had this car either stopped or very close to being stopped.
Well, if you think about it, Larry, since a presidential limousine was brought to a halt, they didn't want to miss anything. They would have stopped too to watch.
Exactly. Now the presidential flag, like I said, has a very strange anomaly coming out of it. Okay, and it's like a squiggly figure that goes up and divides the rear window. Okay, of the lead car, all right? And this would have allowed for masking and opaquing of that area, because if you look at the left of the window, you'll see that there is a figure turned around completely, and he seems to be completely turned around and looking at what's going on behind him. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, watching the whole thing.
I think the whole back window has been obfuscated, so you can't see more clearly that there were as many as 3 looking back at what was going on.
Exactly. So this man, we know that this man is Sheriff Decker, Bill Decker, okay, and he was the one seated in that position in the car. Next to him was Secret Service Sorrels, and in the front seat next to Curry was Secret Service man Lawson. Okay. Now, what really has befuddled me here is that squiggly, like white squiggly line, which is emanating from the flag. Okay.
Right.
Now, this is not part of the fringe of the flag. It's pretty obvious, you know, and nobody, I don't know if anybody was ever, you know, questioned this, you know, and this is something that, you know, it's pretty obvious, you know, in the Alton 7, okay? Now, later on in that same weekend, the Alton 7, when it was published, it was published without the left side of the vehicle, okay? So it did not show Bill Decker or the left brake light, the left rear light, showing the that the lead car had stopped. Okay, and I believe we have an image of that coming up later on, but the next one is going to show us a little bit more detail of what I'm talking about. Okay, now we cannot see Decker. We can see Decker, but we cannot see Sorrels, Lawson, or Curry. And I have outlined here in Teague color the white area that seems to be dividing the rear windshield here, the rear window here,
and of course the brake lights are on.
Brake lights are on, exactly. And this is the same photograph. And I mean, this is a classic because this comes from the New York Times, Jim. And it, you know why? This one makes me laugh because the one you can obviously see, you know, if they have cut out what they want, do not want you to see. All right. You cannot see Sheriff Decker. You cannot see the left light, okay, tail light, you know, of the lead car, okay. You cannot see the upper portion, which was cut out, okay, the railing, the cement railing at the top, okay. And even you, I believe, you have done some research on this, where the position of Clint Hill and Jackie are not even consistent with the Zapruder film.
Yeah, it's very, very curious. And this is a relatively high-definition photograph, as you can see. I mean, this is from a newspaper printing. Look at all the pixels.
Yeah, I scanned this from my own personal copy of the New York Times of November 23rd, 1963, which is when it was published. Okay, so in such a visible newspaper publication, you know, this is what we have, you know, presented to the American public. You know, I mean, I think it's pathetic. The Yalta 7 in all of its splendor.
Yeah, I've noticed that I'm not able to get the slides to advance the way. Okay, here we go. This very interesting case of Lucien Conin having been caught in a famous photograph, which they try to suggest was actually Robert Adams. This is amazing, Larry. Right above JFK's head is one of the face of one of the most famous assassins in the world.
Yeah. And Stanley Carno published a book about Vietnam. And he published a photograph of Lucien Conin there, and it's a dead ringer for this man right here. And I did some overlays for you that I believe we're going to see in a couple of minutes here that sort of established that it might have been one of the same men, you know?
Here's a close-up.
Yeah, this is the Yalta 4.
And here is the claim, this man on the left, this Adams, is supposed to be who is actually seen in the photograph, and Lucien Conin here by comparison. But the Adams thing, it turns out to be so implausible. They were truly grasping after straws, Larry.
Yeah, and I believe Jack White did a study on this comparison. And he was adamant that it was Lucien Conin, you know, that it was not.
Oh, yeah. Well, here, the Adams claimed to have received a plaque for appearing in a photograph in Dealey Plaza, which is absurd. And when they talk about it, they even have the date wrong, Thursday, November 23rd, when, of course, the shooting was on Friday. It was on Friday, and it was the 22nd. So they get it wrong both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about as absurd as it gets. And here was a study Jack did of Adams on the left and Conin on the center and Conin on the right. And notice the features that identify him as square face, short chin, left ear, top out, square face, short chin, left ear, top out, versus Adams, long face, long chin, left ear, top in.
Yeah.
Pretty telling stuff.
And yeah, the photograph is from Stanley Carnell's book. Yeah, this is the overlay that we did here.
So Adams doesn't look like a very good fit, does he? Conin fits. You've done such wonderful stuff, Larry, including, of course, with Doorman. It's absolutely sensational.
Well, I thought that it all boils down to interpupillary distance. When you get those down, you know, everything else just falls into place. If it is the man that corresponds to that image, then it's going to bear out. If not, it's not going to work, you know. So, you know, it's pretty obvious.
Gary, you want to add some thoughts here?
No, it's just devastating how this overlay stuff is just rewriting the books, isn't it?
It's wonderful. This may be the last of the slide set. Yeah, are there any you'd like me to go back to?
No, I think we still got 8 more minutes, yeah. But, I think some of the people that we're getting on in the OIC apparently are being swayed, you know, by, you know, all this new technology and all this research where, for example, this Richard Shattuck originally had stated that he thought it was Billy Lovelady as doorman. Yeah. And now he has, you know, come 180 degrees, you know, and stated that he agrees that it's Lee Oswald.
You know, Larry, I think that Jim DiEugenio did us a huge favor by writing this elaborate attack upon me, because it afforded an opportunity to go through the research and lay it out in great detail. Enough, I think, to convince anyone about any of the diverse subjects that were addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you make those type of statements, you know, in that type of an article, you know, you better be able to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, Jim.
Now, I thought it was a very elementary work, or it looks like to me that he had already written quite a few articles about Peter Janney, Phil Nelson, and Dr. Fetzer, and he seems like he put them all together. It seemed almost like a rushed article. It was just so wide open, and I don't see how anyone who's taken any of the time to go through what Dr. Fetzer's laid out. And like you were saying, it's very easy to make an accusation that you're wrong, and it's very difficult to come back and prove that the person's wrong.
Well, Gary, I think, in fact, a great deal of time and effort was devoted to this, and that he consulted a whole lot of my critics to get their input. Tink Thompson, Robert Groden, maybe even Judy Wood. I mean, I got an email from a supporter of Judy Wood telling me that I had a surprise coming and I wasn't going to like it. And it was quite a while before I put two and two together and realized they were talking about Jim DiEugenio's two-part attack.
Well, I just thought that, for example, this passage that I drew from his article was a little bit ambiguous and a little bit distorted here, because he stated that he had come to have his doubts about photo identification as a reliable method to solve a crime. Yet he relies on Robert Groden and his work as gospel, to assert, a lot of the issues, that, for example, the man in the doorway and that kind of thing, specifically, the shirt, okay, which we all know doesn't even fit, based on, Judy Baker's, pixelation, studies, and that's not even, talking about the overlays that we have done, and when you sort of state this kind of thing about not really wanting to rely about with photographic interpretation, then it's sort of like,
what are you going to do, dismiss all the photographic evidence?
Yeah, the key
is to sort out which is authentic and which is not. Gary, would you like to talk about his methodology and going through each of the speakers who spoke at the Santa Barbara conference? You were the first, I think, to put your finger on it.
Yeah, if you do go through the article, it's every person from the very first speaker all the way to the very last, Larry Rivera, and Don Fox has come into the mix.
The first speaker in Santa Barbara was Phil Nelson.
Mm-hmm. Then we had John Hankey. He criticized Hankey for a long time. Then we had Larry Rivera.
Then Peter Janney.
Yeah, Peter Janney was next, and then Ralph Sinclair, and then you.
No, you left out Ralph Sinclair.
No, I said Ralph Sinclair.
Well, we were talking over one another, but the point is, it does look as though that was the template, don't you think, Larry, that he was going to try to, just take out everything that had happened at the Santa Barbara conference as a demonstration of his superior knowledge over even all of the speakers at the symposium I organized for the 50th observance.
That's right, and we had some really good information that was presented there, and especially Richard Hook's collages there that were really spectacular. Something that had never been done, and I thought that was one of the very highlights of the conference there.
Yeah, you'd made an impression on me, Dr. Fetzer. You said this years ago, that the Santa Barbara conference was the only conference that would have an enduring significance. And that's really come to pass, because this entire article is about that particular conference.
And it's such an utter and abject failure. I mean, no one on objective grounds could support any of the conclusions or criticisms he draws and directs at me. It's really quite ridiculous. Anyone, by the way, who'd like to check it out can find it online, JFK at 50, The Assassination of America. It's on my blog, for example, at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, where you can see all of the speakers, their backgrounds, and their presentations together in one place. Very direct, very accessible. Having gone through all of this, that might be something you want to do. Gary, you want to take us out?
All right, Dr. Fetzer, I admire you for putting in that much time rebutting this ridiculous article. Larry Rivera, kicking rear end as usual with some great new research. We're going to have Don Fox on next week. So I just feel the place to go in JFK research is right here. And I don't understand how Lynn Ostanek puts up with it over there. But I guess that's the way it is. So we'll see you next week. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, Don Fox, myself, and Chance George. We'll see you next week for JFK 98.